All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 68 of the SLS Cast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, episode 68, the March Madness episode. That's right, sports fans. Here's why. It's just, I mean, because it's a little late in the day now. We're at the 25th of March, so that, you know, we've progressed quite a ways to the tournament here. But there were originally 68 teams in the 2014 NCAA tournament here that becomes, you know, that is known as March Madness. And I wanted to make sure that this was something that was reflected in the SLS Cast. So it's the March Madness episode.
Did you do your brackets, your picks?
I did not. And it's kind of sad because it turns out that there one poor bastard who did not enter into Warren Buffett's thing actually made it all the way to like the top 16 or something like that. And I mean, he got every single pick right. And Warren Buffett has a thing. He'll give you $1 billion if you enter, and it's free to enter. You submit your picks, and if you get every single pick for all of the games right all the way down to the winner, he'll give you $1 billion. And this guy did not do it. Now, he had officially put it in, you know, somewhere else, so people were keeping track or whatever, but it was just some kind of other fun thing he was doing or whatever. And they had lamented, you know, dude, you'd totally be in the money. He was the only person in the world who still had everything intact. And then, like, later that day, one of his picks ended up being bad. So he'd be out again anyway. But still, such is life.
Indeed. Life revolves around March Madness. However, my life usually only revolves around one event every year, and that's usually Shark Week on the Discovery Channel.
Oh, so, are we going to get another mermaids thing this time?
I would be surprised if there is not a return of mermaids, the fabricated documentary of those terrifying creatures. But I don't know. You didn't watch that. I know I did, and I talked about it a little bit. Did you get a chance to check out reruns or?
No, I never did. It was just fun having fun with that last year about this time.
Well, you should show your girls, show your daughters, show Libby the mermaid special, and she will never want to watch Little Mermaid. At least
actually,
for another 10 years.
Actually, all I got to do is read her the original Hans Christian Andersen story of the Little Mermaid, and she'll probably never want to watch the Little Mermaid ever again.
Yeah. Well, she'll probably hate you for the rest of her life for ruining.
More likely, which I mean, we have it too. That's the thing, is we've actually got the collection of Hans Christian Andersen here at the house because, with, you know, you got teacher parents and stuff. Well, of course you're going to have good literature in the house along with all the Disney crap. I mean, you got to have the really good literature to back it up. And amongst all of our classics, you know, like Wuthering Heights and the complete collection of Sherlock Holmes and War and Peace and everything, we do actually have Hans Christian Andersen's the collection of tales. And it's just so sad. We're talking about a chick who literally cuts herself down the middle to have the legs, and it's like excruciating pain just to walk. And then he doesn't choose her, and so she dissolves into foam. This poor bastard was sadistic.
And so, for many years, whenever kids go to the beach and they see the foam, oh, I bet so many mermaids died in Galveston.
That's Ariel. Yeah, that's right. You can go, that's Ariel. Just like the first time somebody eats venison, and you can go, hey, you're eating Bambi. And then they get all upset and cry. I did that when I was like 12. It was pretty funny.
There's all those sick and twisted things from Disney movies of the past. It's crazy.
Yeah. And the funny thing is even after all this, we still haven't introduced ourselves. I'm Matt, by the way.
Oh, and I am Tim.
Yes, it only took us 4 minutes and 40 seconds to get there, but we did.
Yeah, and it worked, hopefully. Hopefully we kept their attention enough, and now that they hear our names, they're like, well, you know, we're 4 minutes and 45 seconds into the show now, we might as well finish it. Why not?
Exactly.
We made it this far, why, you know, the next hour and 20 minutes can't be too bad.
And I like the optimistic use of the word they, since we only have the one listener.
Right.
I like your optimism, sir. Your optimism is duly noted. Duly noted. How's your week been, anyway?
It's better now. I mean, it was all right until my girlfriend introduced me to something quite, dare I say, magical for the bathroom experience. And Matt, if you can open up your email real quick, I sent you this link that I want you to
yeah, click. I saw it.
Open it.
I have this thing. I'm trying to make sure that the world, that our optimistic they, gets to hear your glorious dulcet tones. And so I had muted my microphone and noticed in my internet tabs that I had an email. So I literally, just as you were saying that, I clicked over and I see the subject line. I'm like, why is Tim sending? And then I was like, oh yes, the surprise. The surprise. So I guess now I get the surprise.
What was the subject?
So the subject is poop.
And the
one line is poop for show. And I am now pulling it up here. Girls don't poop. Poopery.com.
You would not believe the motherload I just dropped. And that's how I like to keep it. Leaving not a trace that I was ever here, let alone that I just birthed a creamy behemoth from my cavernous bowels. Nothing is worse than stinking up the shared toilet at work, or the toilet at a party, or your lover's apartment. Of course, flushing removes the...
Is
graphics.
This the Orbits
Maybe
lady?
Maybe two or three flushes.
No,
if your skin marks as
I don't think
as
so.
But what can be done of that subtle scent of a...
I wonder if ladies actually poop with dresses like that.
300-cow dairy farm.
Little aerosol air fresheners are the most effective option.
Or the healthiest. Trying to mask the stench, giving you a nice blend of ChemLab carnations with just a touch of feces. So, how do you make the world believe your poop
doesn't
stink?
With a touch of feces.
Or in fact that you never poop at all. Poopery. Poopery is the before-you-go toilet spray that has proven to trap those embarrassing odors at the source and save relationships. Simply spritz
just
poopery
like
in the bowl to create a film on the
pretty
water
much,
surface.
But apparently my girlfriend's father swears by this stuff, and when Chelsea was in Sacramento this past week, her mom gave her some and brought it home because I guess they hear tales about... You know, the bathroom here, apparently, it's all around the family circuit up in Northern California. But I tried it out the other day, and it is quite delightful.
Oh, you tried it, did you?
Yes, I've tried it at least three times a day, even when I'm not, you know, dropping a deuce. It has a very nice lemony scent to it that is quite refreshing. But here's the thing, is that it's not 100% foolproof, because you still get that shit smell, and depending on what you've eaten earlier that day, or the night before, it doesn't quite mix well with a lemon scent. But you'd be surprised on how many different vulgar sounds, or vulgar smells, actually mix well with a lemon scent. So... with saying that, I highly suggest you people check it out. However, it is like $15, so I'm pretty sure you can even make it yourself if you have a poopery making kit at home.
Wow, that is something else there. Good to know they do, for whatever it's worth, make a plastic screw in kind of an insert tool. And it is a vaporizer, and you basically twist it, you smash the top of a lemon with this plastic thing, and then it turns into like a corkscrew, and you screw it all the way down, but it's actually got a little aspirator inside it, so it can make a little, so it's like a little, you're holding the lemon in your hand, and then pushing the little pumper thing on the top, and you will spray pure lemon juice straight from a lemon. And that thing's like $2.
Yeah. Well, this
and perhaps
one has...
maybe that will also mix well with poo.
Well, apparently this has like essential oils in it. But whenever I think of essential oils, I think of whenever they have like that's how they describe like the various super expensive like soaps and body washes and lotions and stuff.
I recently found out that the essential oil is not because it's essential to the product. It's an essential oil is because it releases an odor. That's what makes it an essential oil.
Yeah. So my pee, my urine can be an essential odor, oil. Essential liquid.
I guess if it was oil form.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's, if you're peeing oil, you should probably see a urologist.
Well, on that note.
Yeah. I have nothing to compete with for that. I just had a normal week, so I have nothing that can compete with Vaporize or Poo-Pourri or whatever the hell it is. So I think we should just jump right to it. What do you say?
I say we shall.
All right, here we go, folks. The news! Yes, the news. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and jump in here first. First up for me, coming from ropeofsilicon.com, courtesy of Brad Brevet. David Fincher says, "Gimme bail or no jobs movie." Now, here's a man who's literally kicking the bail. Now, what happened here is that according to The Wrap, in a meeting with the Sony Pictures head, Amy Pascal, Fincher said he'll only make the new Steve Jobs biopic if Christian Bale takes the lead role. Not only is this an interesting ultimatum, it's doubly so because Bale hasn't been approached to do anything yet. So I don't know if maybe David Fincher's like trying to get out of doing it just by making some unreasonable demand, but according to The Wrap, Pascal has a good relationship with Bale, and while she and Fincher had a tense relationship during the filming of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, she believes in Fincher and wants to keep him happy if possible. And much like Brad Brevet, I must say that is some directorial power. What do you think there, sir? Where do you land on this? Is this just kind of a ploy, or... I mean, surely there's got to be an easier way when you're at this level in Hollywood to get a hold of Christian Bale.
Oh, I was thinking of something to compare it to, and I'm completely drawing a blank.
Is it kind of like the Hollywood version of "Do you still beat your wife?" Where there's really no good way to get out of that question without making your opponent look better.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's just a bad analogy. Anyways, all right. Well, you go ahead, sir. What do you got?
And speaking of pooperize, or excuse me, poopery, Glenn Beck has been on the entertainment bracket, news bracket, or news circuit the past week because he has some selective words upon reviewing the Noah movie a few days ago. Actually, I can give you the exact date. 2:28 p.m. At 3:21 March 21st of this year, from a Hollywood Reporter article, Glenn Beck says that he hopes that The Dangerous Noah is a, quote, massive failure, end quote. And apparently on his radio show, which he has about roughly an estimated 10 million listeners, well, on his this past Friday radio show, he said this about the movie, which he, at that time, has not seen. He said that, quote, "I haven't seen it, nor will I, because it's a slap in the face," the host said. Beck read lengthy portions of the Hollywood Reporter's film review, then pronounced his opinion that the movie was hostile to God, and it teaches planet over man. "This movie, if it becomes successful, if we take our churches and we all go and everything else, our children will look at that as being the Noah story. And no matter what you say, they will believe this version over the version that mommy and daddy are telling them or that old dusty Bible is telling them, because this one will come alive in their imaginations. It is dangerous disinformation." The conservative media mogul suggested that if a family wanted to see a fanciful religious movie, he'd rather recommend Oh God or Evan Almighty, because Noah is being packaged as if it will look and feel like It must have felt and looked, which I completely disagree with that. And no thank you. No thank you. I'm not putting that into my mind. And more importantly, I'm not putting it into my kids' minds. I hope that Noah is a massive failure. I hope it is a massive failure, Beck said. A little redundant there. And he is saying all this despite it opened pretty strong overseas. I forget where exactly, but it's rivaling Gravity when Gravity came out. However, the movie is indeed actually banned in Indonesia, if that means anything. I'm sure it does. Also, all these religious groups and religious leaders are coming out and actually praising the movie. Here's one little review right here. Noah is big and bold and entertaining and without a doubt pro-faith and pro-God, said Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, president of the NHCLC Hispanic Evangelical Association. The film expresses biblical themes of good and evil, sin and redemption, justice and mercy, said Jim Daly, president of Focus on the Family. Also, Raymond Flynn, former ambassador of the Vatican, raved about Noah in an article in the Boston Herald, in which he said that, quote, "When people watch this movie, I am convinced it will lead to a broader discussion about the Bible among believers and non-believers alike," end quote. He wrote, "The last time a movie was made about a big and famous boat, people throughout the world wanted to learn more about the Titanic." However, over this past weekend, Paramount executives invited Glenn Beck to private screening. And so this is 3 days after Glenn Beck wished that and hoped that this movie turns out to be a massive failure. And on Mondays, this past Monday's radio show, he said this, quote, "I actually felt like kind of a dirtball basing my review on something I hadn't seen on somebody else's review," Beck said Monday. "That's what people do to me. They don't listen. They don't watch." Beck said, and I'm quoting this from a THR, the Hollywood Reporter article, Beck said that after he ripped into Noah last week based on reviews in the Hollywood Reporter, a Paramount executive did set up a screening for him. "Everybody at Paramount was unbelievably gracious. I would love to be able to come and report that the movie is great, but I can't. It is awful. But not for the reason the reviewer said on Friday. It is awful for 100 other reasons," Beck told his audience Monday, while on Friday he said he hoped that the film would be a massive failure because it distorts the Bible story of Noah and its meaning. On Monday, he didn't seem to think that the movie had the sort of power because it is so laughably bad. And he said, quote, "I believe it is not a godless climate change movie. It's more like Sinbad the Sailor meets Shining and Friday the 13th, with a sprinkle of Mad Max," end quote. The only time he prays is when he's thinking of killing his whole family. Noah in the Babylonian Chainsaw Massacre, he jokingly called the movie. "If you're looking for a biblical movie," he says, "this definitely is not it. I don't think it's an environmental thing as much as it's just a pro-animal and anti-human, and I mean strongly anti-human. There's no redeeming value in Noah. None. He hates people. I'm sorry, no prophet of God hates people. Noah is wrong about everything," end all quotes there. Yeah, I think it's kind of out there too. Of course, it's Glenn Beck, but Sinbad the Sailor meets The Shining and Friday the 13th. Horrible movies, if even what he says is true. Outrageous comparisons right there. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I'm not going to lie. You kind of turned me off when you said Glenn Beck, and not because I disagree with you or anything. I mean, what show was it, like episode 40 or something? We both agree on Glenn Beck, right? But yeah, I mean, I'm sitting there like, okay, this is just not going to be good. This is kind of like the equivalent of the National Enquirer for movies and politics, I guess. Okay, I mean, you're reading it. As you go through the article, okay, he doesn't watch the movie, reads a review about the movie, proclaims it's crap and all this kind of stuff, and that he'll never watch the movie, and then 3 days later, he goes and watches the movie. Doesn't rescind really anything, just kind of softens his original stances on it, and then berates it for a whole new list of reasons, and still, so he gets to be hypocritical and doesn't address that, But then he still wants to berate the film. Okay, I give up. yeah, whatever. Let's see here. Hang on. Wait, I'm trying to take this story. Oh, wait, I dropped that grain of salt I was supposed to take this story with. Now I don't know what I'm going to do.
Oh, shucks.
Damn it. Now I have to take it seriously. Shit.
It's amazing, yet I'm not that amazed that he still has 10 million listeners.
You
They're
know
probably
what, though?
More so in Texas.
You know what, though? If all 10 million of those people listened to us, too...
We'd be like more like Glenn Beck?
I don't think we'd be more like Glenn Beck, but I'd be a lot more thankful for Glenn Beck. Because, you know, somehow his listeners liked our show too, and we'd have 10 million people listening to the show.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's
right?
And that would be a good thing, I think. And anyways, all right, well, moving on to more non-Glenn Beck news.
Maybe half of the, maybe like 8 million of those, that 10 million are people that actually really hate them or hate him. And so they just tune in just to get pissed off.
Oh,
and...
like the Howard Stern detractors?
Yeah.
Who listen
to
him because they never know what he's going to say. They just want to get offended. This is possible. Let's see here. Okay, so coming to us from MTV.com, courtesy of Kat Rosenfeld. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to give Tim a good segue here because he's going to have something that ties directly to this. Ghostbusters 3 is a go. So who are they going to call? With Sony setting start date for 2015... You're going to get to dust off your proton packs and haul the ambulance hearse out of storage because the Ghostbusters are back in business. A report from Deadline confirms that the long-awaited reboot of the Ghostbusters franchise is set to begin shooting in early 2015, albeit without its longtime director. Ivan Reitman, who helmed the two original movies about a group of NYC ghost hunters, has chosen to take a producing role for the next round. And this is as of the 19th. So this is a few days, this is about 6 days ago, and there's going to be some additional news about Ivan Reitman that Tim is going to have for you on that. So he was supposed to have the producing role here, and this was a decision made in light of the death of his longtime friend Harold Ramis. Now, what that says is basically not only do they get to try and figure out who's going to play Venkman and Spengler, Stance, and of course Winston Zeddemore. Who the heck do you think is going to direct this movie? At this point, I honestly don't care anymore. And it's not because of Harold Ramis passing away. I just really think that this is a movie franchise that literally does not need to be remade. It stands on its own. It's funny. It's classic. Yes, the first one is campy and the second one has better special effects but a worse story. But even still, they're still great movies. They're still tons of fun. And with all the speculation that's been going on for the last 10 years, that's just that the public's been really involved in terms of at least knowing about. Everybody's been speculative of it. And of a Ghostbusters 3. But the thing is that, you know, then you have people like Dan Aykroyd who keep trying to put it out there every once in a while. And then, of course, people who start speculating and wonder whatever happened to Rick Moranis, who is actually out there making albums, by the way. He makes, like, Yiddish albums nowadays. And then you've got, you know, like, and then, of course, unfortunately, we have, like, Harold Ramis who passes away. The movies are staying in the pop culture consciousness of today. And so people get to continue to watch them and continue to enjoy them, and it gets to continue to be reintroduced. I really and truly don't think that this needs to be remade. I don't know. So that's really all I want to say. It is a go. It's going to be filming in 2015, which means we'll probably see it 2016 sometime. What do you think, Tim, before you get into your news about it? Do we even really need it?
The rewrites apparently have switched more to a reboot than a direct sequel. So I don't even know if I really... I mean, I think if they're going to do anything, it should be a complete reboot, because I'd just be afraid that they're going to rely too much on the cameos or too much on the older characters trying to, like, sort of be the same or doing some, like, throwback dialogue or little jokes or references that... I don't know,
Don't you think they're going to do that in the reboot anyway? I mean, the reboot is usually when it's ripe for the cameos and the throwback dialogue and the things anyway. I mean,
yeah, but we know, like, Rick Moranis is not going to do it. Bill Murray, more than likely, it will not do it. So, you know, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where Dan Aykroyd really wants to do it, and he's been like the one person who's been really pushing for it. But it's like he really wants to see it, so I think it kind of says something after all the other guys read the script, and even they were like, you know, I don't think it's worth it. So it could be really good, but I'm just worried that what makes the original two special will not transfer over to these other movies, especially since it's completely, it's going to be different people directing, it's going to be different people writing the script. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all I have to say on that subject. That, yeah, I really don't have any other Ivan Reitman news with that one.
But though, because I didn't say exactly what.
What?
What's the Ivan Reitman news?
Oh, that he's not directing the movie?
Well, he wasn't directing in mine. He was producing. In my article.
Oh, okay. I thought you said directing as well. Yeah, so yeah, okay, well, I guess I do. Yeah, he's not directing. The 67-year-old Ivan Reitman, who directed the first two movies and a ton of other classic 80s flicks, will not be returning as director for the next Ghostbusters movie, which kind of stinks, but, you know.
Right, but is he completely out of the project entirely now, or is he still producing?
He's remaining on the project as a producer.
Okay, well,
and Bill Murray is not expected to reprise his role.
Okay, so, well then there we go. So a little bit of a clusterfuck in what we thought was crossover news. Apparently, we did not have any crossover information on that. My bad, our bad, whatever. So Ivan Reitman, Ghostbusters 3, producer, not director. We knew that. That was up. And okay, sorry to take up so much time. Go ahead with your next one. Okay.
So Cheech and Chong are returning with a brand new movie, which could be a good thing or a bad thing. I've been watching, or actually I watched a couple of their stage shows that they did in Austin, which were taped and released to, you can rent them. Or I mean, they're still really funny. They got the timing down still. It's just entertaining. So this might actually be pretty good. This is from another Hollywood Reporter article. In a near interview, Tommy Chong reveals that he and his longtime comedy partner Cheech Marin are teaming up with director Jay Chandraskar, a member of the Broken Lizard comedy troupe, who counts 2001 Super Troopers and 2006's Beer Fest among his credits. He's working a script right now for us, Chong tells CelebStoner.com. We've had some preliminary meetings. It looks really good. It looks really funny. It will be about us going to a festival called The Burning Joint. All sorts of shenanigans happen. It's going to be a lot of fun. End quote. So that is something to look forward to. And then one thing I'm going to tie in with this news update here. So just a Paul Walker Fast Furious 7 update. It turns out he is now going to be CGI'd into the movie. It's going to be a guy that looks like him, but his face, his head, and all that stuff. That's the route they're going to take, is CGI Paul Walker for his unfinished scenes in the movie. And they just started reshoots and shooting again just recently. So I guess look forward to the movie next year.
Just wow. Okay. Bummer. All right, well, let's see. Coming to us from BadassDigest.com, courtesy of Evan Sethoff. Fantastic Four 2, new Wolverine sequel, and Ridley Scott, Fox goes hog wild. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Fox has put dates on some movies so far into the future, it's almost hard to believe. For starters, Fantastic Four will come out July 14th, 2017. Then, they also have a release date for James Mangold's new Wolverine movie, which is going to be March 3rd, 2017. Finally, there is a Marvel movie which currently has no name or announcement. It will come out on July 13th, 2018. And who knows what that will be, or whether anybody's even going to be interested. There have been some breathy rumors saying that it could be X-Force, but meh. On top of that, Fox has also penned a slot for some unnamed Ridley Scott movie. It could be the sequel to Prometheus, but maybe, who knows. All I know is it's just kind of sad that Fox is just desperately trying to cling to whatever little bit of Marvel they still have. Look, we're still making movies, we promise. We promise, you can't have it back yet. No. That's it. That's all I got on that one.
All right, I have some celebrity deaths to talk about here. The first one being, which was a surprise to me, the character actor, which we've all seen him. I mean, I don't think his name probably will not compute within most people. James Rebhorn, born 1948, just passed away, I believe, from complications, I guess, with malaria. He's been fighting malaria since the early 90s. He was 65 years old, and some of the movies, just some of the movies, you will recognize him in. In Meet the Parents, he plays, oh man, I forget his name, but he plays the father-in-law of Jack Burns' daughter, who's getting married. So they're the parents of the guy that they're with. He's also in The Game. Oh, actually, he's the one in Meet the Parents. He's the one that Greg Focker drives his car whenever they all get drunk at the rehearsal dinner or whatever. And yeah, he's speeding in the car, and that's where he has the funny banter and lines about the speeding Focker. And, don't you know how to drive, Focker? You know, stuff like that. He's also in The Game. He's one of the presidential aides in Independence Day. He's in Scent of a Woman. Recently, he was in the TV show Homeland. He was in White Collar, Enlightened, which was on, I believe, just for a very short period of time. More recent movies he was in, The Odd Life of Timothy Green, Sleepwalk with Me, Real Steel, The Sparrow and the Tigress. He was in The Big Lake, A Little Help. He did a couple episodes of 30 Rock, The Box, Don McKay, The International, Boston Legal, Spinning into Butter, Baby Mama, just a whole slew of stuff, as well as television appearances, and he did a lot of stuff on stage and on Broadway. So we're really sad to see him go. He was always a pleasure being able to spot him in movies, and though he hasn't really been, at least in movies, a absolutely huge part, like a leading role, his performances definitely were well worth viewing and enjoying in the movies that he was actually in. Other passings, Patrice Wymore, she was an actress in Errol Flynn's Widow. She passed away at the age of 87. She was Errol Flynn. Errol Flynn was the, Robin Hood, the original Robin Hood from the 1930s. She was his third and final wife. She just passed away. And my last passing is fantastic cinematographer, Oswald Morris. He was born in 1915. He passed away at the age of 19. He passed away at the age of 98. Here, he won the Academy Award in the early 1970s, 1971, 1972, for Fiddler on the Roof. She was the camera operator, cinematographer. He shot Stanley Kubrick's 1962's Lolita, The Guns of Navarone, The Wiz, The Dark Crystal. He even did The Great Muppet Caper, Sleuth, the original Sleuth. Michael Caine was in that one. Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Oliver, the original Oliver, a movie musical, The Winter's Tale. Did a lot of stuff, and he is a fantastic cinematographer. If you don't know him, again, his name is Oswald Morris, and look him up. Go to his IMDb page and look him up, and check out any of the movies that he shot, especially Lolita and Fiddler on the Roof. Fantastic flicks. So again, three passings that I mentioned: Oswald Morris, the cinematographer; Patrice Wymore; and then finally, the character actor, James Rebhorn.
Indeed, and just for clarification, James Rebhorn did pass away of melanoma.
Oh, what did I say? Malaria?
Yes, which is skin cancer.
Yeah.
Which he has been battling since 1992.
Right. Melanoma. And
there you go. All right, well, last but not least for me is a article from Variety.com, courtesy of Ramin Sethude. It's basically Captain America's Chris Evans says he's ready to leave acting behind. And the gist of this article is basically he is committed to fulfilling his Marvel contract, and then he wants out. He doesn't want to act really anymore, at least at this point. That's where he's at right now. Now, he's only 3 movies into a 6-movie contract, so you're still going to see him in Avengers 2. There is going to be a third Captain America movie, and then there's still something beyond that. So, I mean, there's still going to be that. And he actually just recently finished a movie, which is called... 1:30 train, which focuses on a young woman who misses her ride home at Grand Central Terminal and spends the night talking to a street musician. And he actually stars in this, as well as directs. This is his directorial debut. And he credits being Captain America as why he got to direct this movie. And he also knows, and he's very candid, that because of his continued work with the Marvel, and the Captain America stuff and the Avengers franchise, that even if this movie doesn't do well, he's going to be able to direct something again because of his opportunity and his stature now as this. But he's just tired of the acting. He's tired of feeling typecast. Even they also talk about in this article, Scarlett Johansson going on a tangent there as well, saying that it is both a blessing and a curse to be tied in such a way to superhero roles, because they are good for exposure. They will launch you onto your career. He got his big break as Johnny Storm in Fantastic Four, Chris Evans did. And yet now you start to get to a point where you're feeling like you're typecast, you're not sure how it's going to work out, and what have you. So he wants to move behind the camera. And I say more power to him, personally. More power to him. If that's what he wants to do, and he does quality work, then and it makes him happy, then so be it. I've still got my time with Fantastic Four and Captain America and Avengers that I can look forward to and look back on.
I like whenever you say Captain America, you usually say Captain America.
That's right, Captain. Like Captain Crunch, baby.
I'm with the Captain. Okay, so I have my last two things that I will go through really quick here. And Matt, I would love just your on both of these, just a little response from you. Okay, so real quick, Innocence of Muslims, the movie, the controversial movie that just it's spurring lawsuits galore. It seems like the woman who is demanding the background actress Cindy Lee Garcia, who's demanding that Google remove the copies of the movie because they're still there. I mean, you can still view the movie and find it, and she doesn't want her work to be seen. And all this stuff, it goes back to the copyright issues and all that stuff. However, the actress, again, Cindy Lee Garcia, is now demanding that Google to be sanctioned. That's right. This is a Hollywood Reporter article entitled Innocence of Muslims Actress Demands Google Be Sanctioned. And it says that in an emergency motion for a finding of contempt on Tuesday, Garcia's lawyers say that despite being given 24 hours as of February 28th to take down copies of the controversial anti-Islamic film, there are still copies available in Google's system, according to the motion. As this morning at 7:55 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, a version of Innocence of Muslims that includes Ms. Garcia's performance is still available on Google's worldwide platform and also viewable in Egypt, the nation in which the fatwa, or F-A-T-W, I think it's just fatwa, was issued for Ms. Garcia's execution. All a viewer needs to do to view a copy of the video that contains the infringing material from any computer in the world and within YouTube's global platform, and therefore is governed by the takedown order, is to change his or her settings to any country platform, such as Egypt. Well, I know this kind of reminds me of the next thing I want to mention, which I will jump to right now. It's illegal to do it here. I mean, like, it's illegal for Google in certain places to do it. But what they're basically saying, well, to beat the system, because I know you do want to watch it, do this. And that brings me to the Quentin Tarantino and Gawker lawsuit updates, where Tarantino's pissed at Gawker because they made available links to other websites that had the leaked Quentin Tarantino Hateful Eight script. We've already seen that Quentin Tarantino has sued Gawker for the allegedly contributing to the dissemination of his script of the Hateful Eight. And then we've seen Gawker demands that the lawsuit to be dismissed. They want to be dismissed. And now, according to the Hollywood Reporter, is scene three, where it's Tarantino's retort. And it turns out that Tarantino's lawyers say that Gawker contrived the very news story that it now seeks to hide behind. And that would be the post for the script, for the 146-page script. In response to the lawsuit, Gawker asserted that Tarantino himself, quote, set in motion the circumstances by which the script circulated, that its posts about the leaking was a fair news report and that there could be no contributory infringement without direct infringement. Or as Gawker's lawyers put it in a March 10th motion to dismiss, quote, simply viewing a copy of allegedly infringing work on one's own computer does not constitute direct infringement, end quote. And then on this past Monday, Quentin Tarantino filed his opposition, and they have the rest of this article here, and you can find them online, the various legal papers about from Quentin Tarantino's side, you know, their legal papers. So that's pretty interesting. Kind of paints a more broad picture of exactly what's going on and what's in Tarantino's head about why he's really pushing to make this lawsuit go through. And personally, I think it's a good thing he's doing. It's something that we need to establish now. Because, it honestly, Gawker, they seem like a bunch of dickheads, to be honest. So, yeah. Do you have anything to add on to either of those two articles?
Retard people are going to be retard people, and that goes for both stories. I mean, it's true. It's true. Gawker's going to continue to be fucking Gawker's. Quentin Tarantino's at fault. He put himself in the damn situation. And then the stupid lady who is going after Google is just being retarded about the whole goddamn thing now. So... apparently, she seems to think that she can actually take something off the internet. Because you know that can happen, right? That's it. That's all I got. All right. Well, that concludes the news. And now it's time for...
Masterpiece Discussion. Or Discussions with Matt and Tim. This week on Discussions with Matt and Tim... Matt and Tim will be discussing the HollywoodReporter.com article, UCLA Diversity Study Blasts Hollywood as Woefully Out of Touch. You see, on screen and off, minorities and women are drastically underrepresented, even at a cost to ratings and box office, according to a new report which targets talent agencies, Oscars and Emmys, among others. And now, Discussions with Matt and Tim.
Yes, sir. Do you want to go over this article at all, Tim, or what? I mean, this here's your baby. What do you got for us?
The article is kind of pointing out the obvious. We all know that what this other article, it's from Breitbart.com, where they say that Hollywood's attempt to get more diverse is moving at a glacial pace, which I definitely agree with. But UCLA. They released the study, a diversity study, which says that Hollywood is woefully out of touch. And this article goes through and it lists numbers. It lists numbers that are very interesting, and then it lists some numbers of things that just to me don't really make any sense, because I think it's hard to really play the numbers game when you're talking about movies that do well. With certain people being behind the movie, like with if a white person directs one movie and it does great, here are these numbers, compared to if a minority, a black guy, a Mexican woman even directs this one movie, but the box office numbers on that movie are so little. Because what I think it doesn't take what I have a feeling that it doesn't take into consideration is that some of these movies are big budget, some of these are small budget, which then people would say, well, because they're a minority, a lot of minorities are unable to get their hands on producing or directing a big budget movie. That is true. But on top of that, again, I'm not sure that this is one thing that the article really doesn't make clear, that there are a lot of movies that white people make that are absolutely shit, that makes tons of money, or that hardly make any money at all. And it's the same thing with certain minority groups. You can even look at TV, for example. And it's also the content, like what makes up the content. Is it good content or is it shitty content? Because if you look at, like Tyler Perry has like 25 different shows, you know, like Tyler Perry's This Is This, or even you look at like his Diary of a Mad Black Woman movie or any of his other movies. I haven't seen all of them, and so I cannot criticize all of them. But at least I've actually have seen three of his Diary of a Black Woman movies, series of movies, whatever you call them. And I've seen, I don't even remember the name of it, but it was not good at all. So therefore, a lot of people know that, so they're not going to go see it. Unless, say, you know, Martin Scorsese makes a movie, that's great. And then his next movie comes out, and it's utter crap, but people are going to go see it because it's Martin Scorsese. So that's one thing that kind of gets me. It's like, I definitely agree that certain minority groups, that women especially, don't get any recognition. Don't get as much recognition as they deserve. I even think that not only with talking about race and gender, but even with social class, even with high schoolers and college kids, even elementary school kids of all ages. Why not? Because unfortunately, I think now Hollywood is out of touch. Because for one thing, the art isn't recreating a culture; it's actually creating the culture. And to me, that is in part why we get a lot of one-sided films, one-sided material, one-sided stories. They're making whatever they want to make. And unfortunately, that trickles down to movies like 12 Years a Slave, where all the award shows, you hear all about how that movie was a bitch for them to make. And actually, Brad Pitt had to come in. And he's the one that helped really get the movie off the ground. They were able to make the fantastic movie. And there's a number of movies that are like that. John Singleton, recently, he was interviewed, and he's been going on this little tirade about how there aren't enough black directors, women directors, other minority directors. But during this one interview, he was just talking about African-Americans. And he was saying that some of the African-American movies that come out are not good. They're horrible. Because a lot of the executives are white guys or white women. Also, the executives that are black, they're too afraid to, according to him, this isn't me, but he was saying something like some of the black executives are kind of afraid to come out and actually speak up and say something. And so movies like 42, where they brought out Brian Hegland, the director, he had, what do you call them, consultants on the movie. People that specialize in African-American baseball history. Even, you know, 12 Years a Slave, they had consultants. So every so often you have movies that have consultants when it's pertaining to African-American culture or heritage even. But there aren't too many movies that actually do that. I mean, there are those that do it for show, but a lot of when it comes down to it, it's the director and the producers and the studio. Because ultimately, like I was mentioning before, they will do whatever they want to do. If whatever the minority group or whatever the consultant or whatever you're doing comes and says something that you don't agree with, there's no debate or anything. They're gonna do whatever the hell they want to do. Luckily, this has been a problem that has brought to the forefront to where we are working, the movie industry, independent films especially, they're all working to let this happen as much, to kind of put it behind us. But when it comes down to it, really, I think it's all about content. Singleton, he's wanting to make a movie about Tupac, and he's writing a script for it. However, he doesn't know how the hell he'd market the movie. He can't think about how he can find an actor to play him. And he's dreading when he has to begin that process of pre-production because he doesn't know. I mean, he's worried that nothing will ever come out of it. And John Singleton directed a early 90s classic, actually a breakout hit for him, Boys in the Hood. And at the time, he was actually good friends with Tupac. He was doing a documentary with him, I think, in the early 90s. And Tupac was even in a movie of his. So he's trying to be faithful, but again, he just doesn't know if he's going to be able to hold on to that authenticity whenever it comes to making the movie. I'm rambling now, so I'll shut up, because I don't know if I've gone off topic or if I've just said way too much. So what do you think, Matt?
All right. I personally get fed up with articles like this because they come from a perspective of not wanting to solve the problem. They just want to exacerbate negative attention in order to get any kind of attention to direct a problem. Because you have people like Neil Blomkamp, who is an actual African, by the way. People like Alfonso Cuarón, Steve McQueen, that you mentioned before. Of course, John Singleton, also, that you mentioned before. Catherine Bigelow, Guillermo del Toro. These are people who are not just fly-by-night people who just kind of burst onto the scene recently. You're like, oh, no, these are people who have had amazing careers, who have done great movies in more than one country, oftentimes, who are clearly examples of women and non-white people or whatever, minorities, especially in the case of Alfonso Cuarón and Guillermo del Toro, who are making good movies. Because, again, it goes back to what you said. It is really and truly content. But, I mean, you've got two things here that people do not ever mention. First of all, you have all this information is from 2011. Because if they had anything current, it might distance away from the point, which is there's still a problem. Well, if you're using data that's always constantly old, then you are always going to perpetually have a problem. And then we're also dealing with someone who seems to have the point of view, who comes from the position that it's never going to get any better. That because if your whole position depends on it not getting better, why the hell would you want it to get better? And you have to remember, again, they even bring up that the studies are old because it's titled 2014 Hollywood Diversity Report, Making Sense of the Disconnect, which focuses on 172 American-made movies, just American-made movies only, from 2011, and more than 1,000 television shows that aired on 68 cable and broadcast networks between the 2011-2012 season. So this information is already 3 years old. And he says, they say in the article here, future studies will take more current data into account, but there will always be lag, says Hunt, because of the large size of the database and the complexity of analysis. Well, perhaps maybe you need to fix that problem first so that we can have real-time people. We can have real-time information, or much better than real. How about maybe 6 months old or a year old? Why don't you just take the stuff from just 1 year and then, or maybe break down a genre, maybe just break down comedies, maybe just break down dramas instead of looking at the whole thing so that you can see something that'll give you a better picture than just trying to blame it on stuff that's 3 years old. You also have in here Hunt, who is the guy behind the article, who sits here and says that it says here, Hunt is pessimistic that the situation will change anytime soon. There are a lot of white males in position in this industry who are not in a rush to do things differently, he says. There's a self-fulfilling prophecy at work, a vicious cycle, he added, when minorities and women are passed over for opportunities. So he's sitting there implicating people without naming names and doesn't exactly say how or why this problem still exists, just that it does. And there are no solutions offered. As a matter of fact, even in the article here where it's pointed out, told that the DGA had recently achieved contract language that requires each major television studio to establish a formal diversity program by July 1, 2014, Hunt said that, quote, there may be some positive change there, but we'll have to wait and see, end quote. It's like he doesn't even want anything good to come out of it because he's going to be out of a job? It really infuriates me because these people come from simply an aggressive position that offers no solution. It simply says there's a problem and it's somebody's fault, and in this particular instance, the guy goes out of his way to say it's a few white people's fault. Well, how the hell does that solve anything? These articles always make me mad because the data is always dated. We have a 2014 report that's at best 2.5 years old, if not really 3 years old, because you're covering the entirety of January 1st, 2011 through approximately April-May of 2012. I'm sorry, these things just totally piss me off, and they completely ignore the obvious, that there are solutions coming. And that's not to say that there's not an issue that doesn't need to be addressed. But it does sit there and say, you have to look at both sides of this equation. Just because that there is a gap doesn't mean that there is active hate going on. There are lots of variables that go into what constitutes mainstream cinema. And the simple fact of the matter is that when you have people who, as you mentioned, like Tyler Perry, who create stuff that is specifically for the black populace, and it makes money. This guy's, I mean, Tyler Perry's loaded. This guy's net worth skyrockets hundreds of millions of dollars every year. And yet doesn't really achieve mainstream success. It goes back to content. Now, does that mean that the movies he makes are not worthwhile and that they shouldn't be made? Of course not, because he's obviously found a need, albeit to a certain degree a niche, and he has filled it. And it needed to be filled, because if it didn't need to be filled, he wouldn't be making money. But that does not necessarily translate to everybody else is bad because they don't have enough diversity. Well, by God, you know, you don't just focus on U.S. stuff anymore. Half this stuff is made in other countries. Oh, well, it's behind the scenes, too. Well, by God, how the hell are you going to hold a U.S. production responsible for filming in Romania and using Romanians? Well, our Romanians are probably a minority here in the United States, but they're not a minority in Romania when you go and film in Romania. So there's just so many things that go on, and the proliferation of the global nature that has become filmmaking, because they're chasing the tax credits, just like we learned with the VFX industry. That's one of the things that caused the VX house to go under that did Life of Pi. Everybody's chasing the money, and they're chasing the tax credits. And the tax credits aren't just here in the United States. They go to Canada, they go to India, they go to England, they go to Africa, they go to wherever. It's none of that stuff is taken into account. It's just simply, here's a problem, and the problem's never going to go away. Well, if the problem's never going to go away, why even bother doing a study? How about we look at providing solutions to the problem and not be pessimistic for any hope for the future? John Singleton has a point. There's not enough people there, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're being kept away on purpose either. And that's how it gets presented. That's how it's being presented, and it's completely misleading. And now I feel like I'm just going in circles, so I'm done.
Well, one more thing I want to just read here. It's from the Breitbart.com article. One particularly noteworthy year was 2011, a 12-month span in which minorities had lead roles in less than 11% of the 172 under study. The latest census data says non-whites made up roughly 36% of the U.S. population. The failure of Hollywood to accurately mirror the nation's multicultural nature is putting a major dent in potential box office and ratings, added Hunt. Audiences tend to gravitate towards films and TV series that feature diversity, which translates into higher profits for networks and studios. And case in point, the article says, the wildly popular Fast and Furious franchise. Yes, the series focuses on beautiful people, elaborate stunts, and ultra-cool cars. The cast, however, reflects a diversity too rarely seen on the big screen, a veritable melting pot of nationalities working together for a common sense. And I will say this, that one thing that gets me is when you watch a movie which features, like, a heist movie. You know, it's like watching Ocean's 11, but they purposely leave white people out and put in a Mexican guy, a Chinese guy, a black guy in the movie. And it's just obvious, because you watch that and you're like, okay, yeah, it's, you know, it's a diverse group. But if it happens too often, it'll become, I mean, it's like, it's whenever those movies are made, it's going to be like a checklist. Like, do you at least have this type of person in this movie? Do you have this type of person? It just doesn't make sense. I went and saw the movie, the Need for Speed movie, the Aaron Paul movie, a few weeks ago. And one thing that got me was that though they're talented actors, I'm not taking anything from their acting ability, but because it was such a diverse group, it just seemed like it was purposefully a diverse group. And I'm pretty sure it was after reading this, all of this articles, and just doing research on this. You know, it's just amazing how they purposely do it in hopes to please people. Though I kind of think, and Matt, I'm sure you agree, that if the movie is good, people will watch it.
I do agree with you on that. Okay, my zero star movie, my hated movie of last year was Elysium. Okay, that was directed by Neil Blomkamp, but and while it did, the biggest star was Matt Damon. But they also made a point of using other stars. Carto Shopley, right, I think his name is, who I didn't like him in that role. But I did like him in Europa Report. I thought he did good there. And then, of course, and they had a few Latino actors as well. And then, of course, they saw Jodie Foster, too. That was the one thing that I took as a positive from that movie, was the diverse cast. Now, that is okay. But once again, these were people who could act. You can't just throw anybody up there. People are not pasta. You can't just throw them up against the wall and expect that it's going to stick. You have to get quality people. For example, when we fell in love with the back, what? God, I can't, was this, I don't even remember if this was in Reboot or not, back in the first round, when we saw the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy. That was the first time I'd ever noticed Michael Nyqvist, who also is in Europa Report. And they had, it was just really good actors. They had such great actors. I was so excited to see them. And then when you get movies like, oh, good Lord, Guillermo del Toro just did it.
Pacific Rim?
Yes, thank you. Pacific Rim, where you have actors from all nationalities coming in and playing, and you have these big global roles, and you have movies like Europa Report, which have actors and actresses from all over the globe. That is cool. That is good. But again, they're good actors. They're doing good work. And that's what makes it so much fun. And yes, it is a bonus because now you can go and play it in Asia and it does well there. And you can play it in Europe and it does well there. And you can play it in Latin America and it does well there. No, that's all fine. That's well and good. As a matter of fact, I'm sure it makes the suits happy because then they make even more money anyway. But it still, again, all comes down to quality. And I think that's what it really is. It's not that the solution's not out there. It's that the solution is still quality. And I don't know. You guys check it out for yourself. The Hollywood Reporter article that we've been heavily, primarily based out of, HollywoodReporter.com, UCLA Diversity Study blasts Hollywood as woefully out of touch. It's from the 12th of February, 2014, courtesy of Jonathan Handel. And that's that.
Well, who knows? Maybe we're out of touch.
I don't know. I don't think so. I really and truly don't think so. But that's just me. let's see here. So, next time on
Discussions with Matt and Tim on Masterpiece Discussion, which will be next week, as a matter of fact. We're doing back-to-back episodes of Masterpiece Discussion. We're going to be discussing the article from the Daily Mail Online, which, of course, is dailymail.co.uk, courtesy of Daily Mail Reporter. The Resurrection of Mel Gibson calls for actor to be accepted back in Hollywood fold fall on deaf ears as film bosses stay away. This is a op-ed piece basically stating the facts of Mel Gibson's transgressions and wanton return to Hollywood status, Hollywood star status, and asks the question, has he suffered enough? And we will be discussing both his transgressions and trying to answer that question next week on Discussions with Matt and Tim, a.k.a. Masterpiece Discussion.
And there we go.
Girthy discussion.
Yeah. Well, that takes care of that, so I guess we're down to the last segment, are we not?
That we are.
Then let's do it, folks. Here we go. The movie. Yes, the movies. Okay, folks, we had Stolen, the 2012 film featuring Nicolas Cage. Sightseers, the British black comedy featuring Alice Lowe and Steve Oram. And finally, Stand Up Guys, the 2012 criminal comedy film featuring Al Pacino, Christopher Walken, and Alan Arkin. Where do you want to start first, sir?
Let's go with Stand Up Guys.
Stand Up Guys. Okay, folks. Again, the 2012 American criminal comedy film directed by Fisher Stevens, starring Al Pacino, Christopher Walken, and Alan Arkin. And when we say and Alan Arkin, we literally mean and Alan Arkin.
It should be more like a and Alan Arkin.
I was like, why the hell is he getting equal billing in all this shit? He's in the movie for like 6 minutes. It's a good 6 minutes. Don't get me wrong. You get the impression going in that he's like this, you know, major figure in the movie, and he's not. All right, so this is a movie about two old friends reuniting after one of them, who played by Al Pacino, has spent the last 28 years in jail. He's met up with his other friend, who is played by Christopher Walken, and they are basically spending the day together, trying to have a good time, you know, get the old sea legs working again for Al Pacino's character Val. Unfortunately, there's an undertone to this day and a little bit of nervousness, and it revolves around a botched, I guess, robbery, really, that landed Val in jail, and how that situation has to play out along the rest of this day that they spend together. This movie is advertised as a criminal comedy film. It's really not all that funny. It's not a bad film. Don't get me wrong. It's not a bad film, but it's really not all that funny. The funniest part was for me finding out just exactly how they take care of an erection that lasts for too long after you've overdosed on Viagra.
Is that true?
Because I did. I'm assuming so. Wait. You mean to say that Hollywood lied to me again? Damn it! that scene in and of itself is totally worth watching. It was also interesting. Juliana Margulies plays like a nurse or something in the ER in this movie, and I'm like, well, if that isn't just a return to your roots? But yeah, so that scene was actually funny. Outside of that, the movie is not. It's not really all that funny. It's chuckle-worthy. You're going to get some smiles out of it. The characters are very interesting characters. I want to say that for me, the writing was poor. Because while they were mildly interesting characters, and I think the direction was done to bring the story out and flesh the story out as best as it could have been, you've obviously got some heavyweights here dealing, you know, portraying it, but it's just kind of like age has literally caught up with these actors, and I don't know that they did a poor job necessarily, but I just really didn't feel like this was the best vehicle for their ability. That being said, it's got a kind of a touching ending, and it's likable enough. A little slow overall, but I did like it. It's somewhat cliched. It's a simple movie. I'm just going to go ahead and land on 3 stars. I liked it. And if you've got nothing better to do on a rainy day, check it out.
I like this one a little bit more, just a 0.5, just a 0.5 more, I guess. So I rate this movie 3.5. I thought the performances were great. I thought it was great fun. It just, to me, it looked like they had a ball. And whenever the movie started to get repetitive, because they revisit some of the same dialogue and the same settings and scenes a few times, it just gets a little bit repetitive. But then Al Pacino just realize, you know, just sparks, puts a jolt into the movie where he is just so damn entertaining. And when the movie is sincere, it's very sincere. And I just got the feeling that Al Pacino and Christopher Walken were the best of buds, you know, like they actually love each other because they're good friends. And Christopher Walken, you know, he's hired to kill him. You find that on early on in the movie. I felt the struggle there. And I just liked all the nostalgia that the characters had, like revisiting their old haunts and getting the group back together. and all that stuff. It was just, it was just fun and entertaining, and I thought it was done in a very, I guess, tongue-in-cheek way. However, I agree completely. The movie is cliched. We've seen a lot of it before. We've seen the opening of a movie where a guy is being let out of prison because he just, you know, he's on parole or whatever. We've seen that before. We've seen that in Blues Brothers. We've seen that in so many TV shows. We didn't need it with this movie. It's just something that I will criticize any movie that has it, because there's just too many. It's just kind of like the cheap, formulaic way to show that, I guess, story progression or whatever. But they rehash the They Live line. I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum. Or I'm here to kick ass or chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum. They reference that line a few times. And again, that's another one that's been reused and rehashed through various movies. A whole bunch of movies. But other than it being repetitive, and that Alan Arkin was, I thought, wasted, I felt. He's only in the movie for a short period of time. Though his character is involved in the story during that time, you often don't even see him. So I don't know what was going on there. But they could. I just wanted to see more of him, because once his character started to get going, I wanted to see the dynamic between the three of them play out more. But other than those critiques, I thoroughly enjoyed it. 3.5 out of 5 for me.
Right on.
Oh, wait. And I thought the movie should not have ended with a shootout. I was fine with the uncertainty of their characters, but they should not have ended it with the shootout, I felt. I thought it just kind of took away from the whole character emotion thing.
I just wasn't trying to spoil the ending too much in case people wanted to watch it.
Oh. Well, you know.
That's your thing. Hey, that's your bag. Except it's the actual ending.
Yeah. But I mean, you knew it was going to happen. You knew what, I mean. Or maybe
yeah.
not.
Yeah. All right. Well, where do you want to go from there, sir? We've got Stolen and Sightseers.
Let's go with Sightseers, since you...
Really? You wanted to do this one in the middle? Okay, right on. I'm a little surprised, but we're going to go with it. Let's do it. All right, so Sightseers. This one...
You loved it, right? It's Matt's favorite. You already ordered it on Blu-ray, right? In Disney Digital 3D?
Yes, that is indeed accurate, sir. And by indeed accurate, that's full of crap. Sightseers, of course, the British black comedy film directed by Ben Wheatley, written and starring Alice Lowe and Steve Oram, along with some additional material from Amy Jump. This, of course, is produced in part by Edgar Wright, who is Tim's boy. This is the guy that he got to fawn and fumble all over when he actually had the opportunity to meet him. Yeah, you're never going to live that down, are you? World famous in like 10 years, 15 years later, and you're going to be on This Is Your Life, the whatever incarnation of that it's going to be, and I'm going to walk on and go, remember that time you had a fool out of yourself in front of Edgar Wright?
Not going to be the last time, I'm sure.
And then Tosh is going to come out and say, we're going to give you another opportunity. Here's Edgar Wright. And, you know, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. All right. So back to this. Okay. So this is supposed to be a black comedy. And we have a young man by the name of Steve Oram, or the actor Steve Oram. His name is Chris. He's a Caravan fan and a would-be writer who's taking his girlfriend, Tina, played by Alice Lowe, on a road trip, much to the chagrin of Tina's mother, who is ridiculously eccentric, somewhat bitter old woman, who basically hates her daughter for having killed her dog by accident. I'm going to use the air quotes because you can't see them here. This is, of course, audio. And they go on a road trip that turns into basically the road trip of death. Now, Sightseers if you can imagine this for me, let's imagine a wonderful sexual tryst, a menage a trois, if you will, that consists of the following movies: Juno, Natural Born Killers, and Prince Avalanche. If those three films got together and had some kind of unholy union consummated, this would be the film that would be birthed before you. And while each one of those movies has great merits and some things that you might not have liked about them as much, what happens with Sightseers is the most ridiculously overthought, overwrought, unfunny piece of shit you could possibly get. Remember the movie Twins with Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger? When they tell Danny DeVito, "You were the leftover crap," that's what Sightseers is. This movie is completely off the fucking rails, stupid. Everything that they try to do is to try and be intentionally quirky, but over the top with its quirkiness. Anything that tries to make sense, they try in the guy, even in his ridiculous fucking state of being justified in what he does, is completely done to the nth degree by the woman, who's completely coming unhinged, more and more unhinged. It's almost like a competition to see who is the most unhinged, while they justify their actions and decide exactly what it is that they wish to achieve with their actions. The problem is, there's nothing really funny about it. Not only is it not funny, it's retardedly predictable. And you're like, okay, well, this is just going to be stupid because they keep inventing more and more outlandish ways, which are supposed to be funny, mind you. They're supposed to be funny. But really, by the end of it, is really kind of sad. And then the penultimate move, when the actual ending of the film occurs, you're like, what? How the... And then you can still see what's about to happen. And then when it happens, you're like, well, of course, that's how it's going to go down. This movie is absolutely dumb. There were two. I counted them on one hand, two funny parts in this movie. One that occurs early on, and then one that occurs about 15 minutes after that initial laugh that I had. And everything else is just simply gags that are trying to reach out there to fill the material and fill the time to tell this ludicrous story that just was very, very poorly executed. Now, that being said, this is a one-star movie for me. I hated this film. I could not wait for it to be over, which was sad because I was really looking forward to watching this movie. All that being said, I perfectly am capable of understanding that I am in the minority on this film. I am completely in the minority here. This film has 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. So this is definitely certified fresh, but I just want to make sure that it is known that even though everybody else seems to like it, I guess I'm the only one who hated it. We can put this on the fucking list for that. So there we go. One star. Do not wish to see any more movies by either one of these people, especially if they write the movie. And it kind of makes me a little mad at Edgar Wright, too. But him I'll forgive, mainly because I just want to make sure that Tim gets another chance to screw it up when he meets him.
All right, so Matt hated this movie, and I think it's safe to say that you'll either hate this movie or you'll really like it. I think it's safe to say that this is one of those movies where you just can't say it was okay. It's either it's one side or the other. It's just one of those movies. But I'm among the people that really like this movie. I give this one 4.5 out of 5. People that have criticized, not just Matt, even people that have given this movie positive ratings or positive scores or whatever, they've said that the movie was not funny enough. However, I personally feel that this movie doesn't need to be, I'm doing my air quotes, funny. I think the movie is smart. I think it's well made. It features well-rounded characters, a well-rounded story, and it doesn't feel forced or that they're trying too hard to be weird, that they're trying too hard to be funny. It just felt as natural as this particular story was able to allow these characters or allow these actors to, you know, to feel natural or to be somewhat relatable in whatever way. They used it. They did it as they did that. They did it as much as they could, is what I'm trying to say. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. Though, I mean, I did have some issues with it. I thought that the man's intentions. Again, this is a kind of a spoiler here. So if you're wanting to see this movie, probably stop the recording here. Go watch it, come back and re-listen. Or not re-listen, but just listen to me. Why not? Unless you hated it, then listen to Matt, then you can just skip past what I'm saying. That I thought the guy's intentions towards the woman was a bit, what did I write here? It was a little bit cloudy towards the end. Because he was, they loved each other. Then he became annoyed with her and didn't want to be with her. And then all of a sudden, at the very end, he is suddenly, passionately in love with her. And, of course, this then leads to the very last few moments of the movie. And for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet, I'm not going to spoil it, but let me just say that if they had this character situation thing, you know, figured out a little bit more, or if it made more sense, I think the impact at the end of the movie would have been a little bit more, what the fuck? Or a little bit more like, oh, like, I don't necessarily say breathtaking, but a little bit, I guess you'd be a little more taken back. So there you go. 4.5 out of 5. So go see it.
Right on. Or don't. Or don't. All right. Well, last but not least is Stolen, the 2012 film. This is...
oh, man.
One of the reasons why...
Let me get my notes, the book that I wrote.
This is one of the reasons why there is a... there's a joke that goes around that circulates the internet that originated in Hollywood where Nicolas Cage cannot say no to a role. And there's a reason for that. And this is one of those reasons. This movie stars Nicolas Cage. A few people you may or may not have ever heard of. And then Josh Lucas, who you hopefully should have heard of. And this...
Well, the cop guy. The cop guy is pretty...
Yeah, was that...
Is well known.
Sammy Gale, or no, MC Gainey? No, that's the guy from Lost.
Is he Houston? Last name Houston?
Danny
or
Huston, yeah, or Houston, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, Mark Vallée. I forgot, I like him. He was on a TV show I liked for about a week. Yeah, so there's some people that you've definitely heard of. But let me tell you, this basically is about a group of people who do robberies and heists or what have you, and they go after a robbery, and the robbery goes slightly awry, made worse by Nicolas Cage's partner, who's going unhinged and trying to kill somebody, and then, yeah, everything goes to shit, and Nicolas Cage ends up getting caught. 8 years later... He comes out from prison and his daughter gets kidnapped because his ex-partner is pissed off about the botched robbery, even though it was his fault. Now, that's pretty much the plot. He's got, of course, now he's only got so much time to get the money and do all the stuff and rescue his daughter and everything. First of all, I think I should just lead this off. This ought to tell you about the quality of this film. I received, you know, because Tim and I, we talk. I mean, we have other things beyond the show, and so we chit-chat quite frequently, and we see things. And this actually made me laugh quite a bit. Stolen raped every actor out of having good hair. Even the 8 years spent in prison couldn't rid Nick Cage of his hair. That's how tightly woven. I think it was because the entire makeup and special effects budget was spent on keeping that hairpiece in place. This was a guy who ran, swam, smoked, got in smoke situations, sweated, and the hair didn't fucking move, man. It was like the fake breasts of hair pieces. No matter what position he was in, his hair never moved. It was fantastic. Then, of course, so you've got this just ridiculous, over-the-top acting. The character performances aren't wooden. It's just there's so... Like I said, every trope in the book is just slapped in the face. So nothing is believable. None of the performances are believable because they're just so completely over the top and fitting of everything that you've ever noticed in any kind of movie that's ever like this, that you're just kind of like, well, of course he's going to talk like that, and of course it's going to go this way, and of course it has to go this way. And then, of course, we get to Josh Lucas. Poor, poor Josh Lucas. Now, I said this before when we were doing some pre-show stuff. First time I ever saw him was in 2002 Sweet Home Alabama, and I thought it was a pretty good movie. It's kind of a rom-com, but... And he played the male lead in the movie, and it was the first time I'd ever seen him in a movie, and I kind of related to his character a little bit, and I wished good things for him, you know, and I was kind of excited and hoped that we'd have... Then the next time that I actually remember seeing him in anything was in Stealth, in 2005 Stealth, and the movie really isn't all that great, but he didn't do such a terrible job, and I was like, okay, well, that's not so bad. I mean, you know, you could come back from that. And then he does this movie, and I was just like, I mean, literally all I wanted to do was just say, buddy, where'd you go wrong, man? What happened? He is the most ridiculous, over the top villain I have seen in the last 2 years. I think that if he had actually... The only thing that he could have done to make himself more over the top would be to literally start uttering lines from The Room. That's about the only thing he could have done. Especially by the time you get to the penultimate finale of this film, when he morphs into the most unkillable villain ever in the history of unkillable villains. Actually, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a sequel. That's how unkillable this motherfucker is. And he's totally crazy and totally just dumb. Yeah. And yet you still kind of enjoy the movie. That's the saddest part of all, is despite every trope in the world in the book being broken, and despite all the performances that are completely predictable, and despite the story that has just been so completely overdone, you're wondering why you watch it in the first place, and the terrible performance by Josh Lucas, and the hair that won't quit from Nick Cage, you still kind of like the movie. I think that's just the endearing quality of Nick Cage. But I cannot forgive how piss poor this movie is. And even though it's so technically bad, I still liked it because it does start falling into, very quickly falls into the category of it's so bad it's good. I'm just going to walk away saying that this movie is okay. I'm going to give this 2.5 stars. Because I can't justify anything more than that. Even though I liked it, it's really only okay. 2.5 stars for me. Go ahead, Tim. What do you got?
Yeah, I like the Josh Lucas thing at the end where they do like the Terminator hero shot where it's Josh Lucas's metal leg Terminator shot with the blazing fire in the background, and you know, it's just like the scene is just missing the human skulls that with this prosthetic leg he needs to step on for it and smash. You know, because you don't see any part of his body. It's like you know that this character will not die because you see his pasty white real leg and then you see his metallic fake leg. So it's just...
Pretty sure that if you zoomed in on that leg, it probably said Cyberdyne on it somewhere.
It looked like they were shooting in apocalyptic Los Angeles than in New Orleans. I thought the music was very exciting. The music kind of reminded me of a 1970s buddy cop show. You know, it was like the kind of like a little bit of like the A-Team horns in it, and then you have a little bit of, you know, some funky Rockford Files going on in there. You know, just, well, maybe not. Yeah, even some Rockford Files, why not? But, you know, any 70s movie or TV show that features two cops, or even just one cop, where it's like the worst overused cliche formulaic storyline, but the music is still pretty bitchin'. So I thought that was pretty entertaining. I like how things take just a little bit longer than they should. And what I mean is, like, running from someone or running away from something. It's like at the beginning of the movie when Nick Cage has to go back for the money bag, the bag of money. You know, he's at the van delivering Josh Lucas, and then he's like, "Oh no, I forgot the cash." And he goes back, and then it cuts to the cops inside of the bank, like, "Oh yeah, we need to go this way." And then it cuts back to Nick Cage, and he's only run like maybe a foot and a half. Then it cuts back to the then it cuts back to the cops who are in the lobby, you know, maybe 300 feet away from Nicolas Cage, and it cuts back to Nick Cage and he's gone maybe another foot. Cuts back to the cops and they're maybe 200 feet away, and it cuts back to Nick Cage and it looks like he actually backtracked, you know, during that time. And so, of course, via editing, and you can tell that they're doing it to build tension and not for it to be too fast, but it's obvious that they were intentionally doing it for that effect. And there's scenes of people falling. There's Nick Cage falling when he falls off the balcony and he lands on a table or whatever, you know, bench or whatever the hell he lands on. Oh my God, there are so many shots. It's kind of like those gratuitous shots when something like a house explodes in a movie or an airplane explodes in a movie, and then you see the one shot where it's like, and it cuts to another shot and you see the explosion again, and then you see the other shot, the explosion, and they just do that so you know they just want to show every freaking thing on screen. It's you get the same exact feeling on here. Let's see, another thing that gets me, so whenever the cab gets pulled over with his daughter in the back seat in the trunk, and during that time she managed to cut a hole into the back seat through the leather, so there's a hole there, so if somebody like a cop, you know, happened to pull over Josh Lucas in the cab, then maybe she could scream for help. However, whenever the cop actually does pull over the cab, she doesn't utilize the hole that she was just fingering through, trying to finger the guy behind him, trying to get his attention. She just starts banging and screaming in the trunk and not, like, sticking her fat little buzz-cut head through the fucking hole of the seat. That's another thing. Oh, and one other thing. Another thing. Horrible actress. Oh my God, the girl who played his daughter. Horrible haircut and a little over actor. I could just go on and on about this movie, especially with Danny Huston or Houston. You know, he hates Nicolas Cage, and at the end he loves it. It's weird. This movie definitely belongs in the early 90s, because that is how ridiculous this movie is. So yeah, I give this one 2.5 as well. You know, I've been thinking about this movie all day long, trying to figure out what to rate it, but I was entertained through the entire movie. I was entertained, but not for all the right reasons. Or maybe they were for the right reasons. I don't know. Maybe we should buy the movie and watch the commentary. Who knows?
Probably you let not. Me know how that turns out.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, next week we're going to be doing a little bit of a combo pack here for us. We are going to be doing one Netflix movie followed by two movie theater movies. Next week's going to be Booker's Place, A Mississippi Story, and that is a documentary on Netflix, followed by The Grand Budapest Hotel and Noah, both of which are in theaters now. And I think that pretty much brings us to the spiel, does it not, sir?
Yes, sir. Spiel on.
Very good. Well, the music, as always, that you've been listening to has been brought to you by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com, reverbnation.com, facebook.com, and myspace.com/criesofsolace. As for us, well, of course, we're the SLS Cast. You can go to our website, slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. You can also go to Facebook there and search the SLS Cast. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and favorite us on Stitcher. And I believe that's all. So, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Walt Disney, I get to say this. It's kind of fun to do the impossible.
Oh, that was ended quite abruptly. Talk to you next week.
Cool, man. Cool.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.